Good morning. It is 9 a.m. We are here today, October 7th, 2020, in the Opioid Hearing Room, Suite 907 of the DNA Building in Hagatai, Guam, for the formal hearing continuation of OPAPA 19-011 and 20-003, Basil Food Industrial Services Corporation versus the General Services Agency. Presiding over the hearing today is Public Auditor Benjamin J.F. Cruz. For the record, also present from the Office of Public Accountability are Jarek Hernandez and Clarissa Roque. Will Appellant Basil please identify themselves and any institutional representatives present for the record?
Good morning, Jerry Diaz on behalf of Basil Foods Industrial Services. The institutional representative available today is Mr. Michael Zuhus, the president of the corporation.
Thank you. Will Purchasing Agency GSA please identify themselves and any institutional representatives present for the record?
Good morning, Sandra Cruz Miller from the Office of the Attorney General representing General Services Agency. Institutional representatives present today are Mr. Robert Kono, Chief Procurement Officer Claudia Afaji, and Buyer Supervisor Anita Cruz.
Thank you. Will interested party SH Enterprises please identify themselves and any institutional representatives present for the record?
Good morning. Vanessa Williams on behalf of interested party SH Enterprises. My institutional representative today is Ms. Hui Suk Min, the Vice President of SH.
Thank you. We may proceed.
Thank you very much, Council. Good morning. Do I understand that there will be no further witnesses presented?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay.
That's correct. And I would like the opportunity sometime this morning to move the exhibits that we went over in the past 2 days into evidence.
Okay. I'll allow that. I will hear closing this morning, but I'll also give the parties an opportunity to file the findings of fact, conclusions of law, by next Wednesday, 7 days, okay? It's not required. If you want, please do, okay? And why don't we hear your motion to move before we hear closing?
A Basil makes a motion to move the exhibits that we had reviewed in the past 2 days in this hearing. There are exhibits from both Basil's list, SH Enterprises list, and GSA's list, and I'll read them off to you. So for Basil's exhibit list, it's exhibits 1 through 9, 11, 13 through 15, 17, and I'm designating the document that was presented to the parties on Monday. It's a document dated February 17, 2020. It's a bid status report from GSA. I'd like to designate that as Basil's Exhibit 18 and admit that into evidence as well, or move to admit that into evidence. From SH Enterprises list, I'd like to move into evidence Exhibit B as in boy, and D as in David. And for GSA's exhibit list, I'd like to move into evidence exhibit F as in Frank, K as in kite, and L as in Lisa. Thank you.
Thank you. GSA have any objection to the listing provided by appellant?
No objection to moving Basil's exhibits into evidence. I would ask the OPA to take judicial notice of the procurement record, which is kept as a matter of law, the agency report, which is also kept as a matter of law, and GSA's exhibits, all of which are excerpts of those two records.
Okay. Ms. Williams, do you have anything you wish to offer into evidence?
No, I think all that covers all the exhibits, and we have no objection to both Basil and GSA's motions.
Ms. Diaz, any objection to what's proffered by the government?
I have no objection.
Okay, great. Got that resolved. Are we prepared for closing at this point?
Yes, thank you.
You will be you're recognized. Ms.
Thank
Diaz.
You. I wanted to thank the OPA for and the public auditor for allowing Basil to present This is really not a complicated case. We've got two main issues which we've been discussing the past 2 days. The first issue is whether or not GSA correctly found SH Enterprises to be both the lowest responsible bidder and a responsive bidder pursuant to GSA 5619. The second issue is whether SH Enterprises favored to the government by allowing the government to utilize the Huckable Town building as a violation of the terms and conditions of bonds, procurement laws and regulations, as well as the GSA 5619 contract. So on the first issue, in the past few days, we've examined SH Enterprises' non-compliance with an April 2019 emergency procurement contract.
Can be moved. You can speak without it.
Oh, thank you. Those violations which we honed into include a C rating from public health regarding multiple violations of the food code committed by SH Enterprises. And the other is their inability to deliver the meals to the MUCO in a timely manner. And if you look at both the April 2019 contract as well as GSA 5619, we're dealing with similar, if not identical, contracts where you're providing meals to our MUCO, which have to be delivered in a timely manner and have to be prepared at a certain level such that there's no issue regarding injury or stomach issues to our Manoku. When Ms. Claudia Akbaji and Ms. Anita Cruz were on the witness stand, they both indicated that these were material items such that SH Enterprises should have included information regarding this non-compliance in their bid packet for GSA 5619. And the other important thing about this is that these non-compliance of the April 2019 contract occurred just 6 months before SH submitted its bid packet for GSA 5619, so it's fairly recent, and it would have a strong bearing on their ability to carry out the requirements of GSA 5619. We also discussed submitting the entire inspection report by public health as part of the bid packet. And when Basil previously raised this to GSA, GSA issued a response on November 30th, 2019. It was a written determination, which is SH Enterprises Exhibit K. And they said that SH's failure to do so was simply a minor informality because they believed that Basil had also failed to turn in their inspection reports. But it's really hard to look at this as a minor informality in this case. This was critical and highly important information needed to assess whether or not they were a responsible bidder. And if you look at Section 16 of the contract's general terms and conditions, which is found on page 26 of 151, Basil Exhibit 7, it specifically lists 8 factors that GSA is to take into consideration when determining the lowest responsible bidder. And 2 of those factors relevant today are, 1, the quality of performance of the bidder with regard to prior contracts, and in this case it would be the April 2019 contract, and the other is whether the bidder can perform promptly within a specific time frame. And that was also an issue in the April 2019 contract, because they couldn't deliver the meals, which led to their withdrawal or cancellation of that contract. If you look at Procurement Law 5 GCA 5201 subsection G, it defines a responsive bidder as one who has submitted a bid which conforms in all material respects to the IFB. Now here, SH Enterprises' willful omission to include a complete copy of their inspection reports, their failure to advise of the C rating due to their inability to meet the food and safety standards, and their inability to deliver the food in a timely manner, makes them non-responsive. And because of this non-responsiveness, they effectively precluded GSA from making an accurate determination as to whether or not they are a responsible bidder. So to ensure the integrity and the fairness of the procurement process, and to also abide by the procurement laws and regulations, which require the award to be given to the lowest responsive and responsible bidder, Basil believes that the sole remedy in this case is the immediate termination of the contract and the rebid of the contract for food services pursuant to 5 GCA 5452 subsection 8. Now on the second issue regarding Basil's ethical complaint, the law is clear. If you're a government contractor, you cannot provide a gratuity or a kickback or a favor to the government, even if it's for something that Mrs. Mann clarifies or deems a good cause. It's a strict liability rule, and once it's violated, the vendor is liable for their actions. So one of the relevant regulations here is 2 GAR 11107 subsection 4. And that particular section states that it's a breach of ethical standards for any government contractor to give or agree to give an agent of the government a favor or gratuity during the pendency of any matter related to the procurement, including contract performance and warranty periods. In this case, SH Enterprises became a government contractor on November 8th. When they were awarded GSA 5619. And at that very instant, they became bound to all the procurement rules and regulations as well as the contract terms regarding the prohibition of ethical violations. We have testimony from both Mr. and Mrs. Min that they not only read through the contract terms and provisions and understood them, but they've also been procuring food services for the government stemming all the way back to 2004, which is roughly a 16-year period. Due to their familiarity with the procurement process and rules and regulations, there really is no excuse that they can raise to say that their act of granting this favor to the government is okay. During the past few days, I went through all the different specifications in the contract which deal with these ethical violations. And it's not just located in one part of the contract or in two different parts of the contract. It's actually stated 9 times. We have the affidavit regarding no gratuities and kickbacks, which is on page 7 of Exhibit 7, which is the contract, and it's base stamped. Page 89. We also have the affidavit regarding ethical standards, which is on contract page 8, and it's beat stamped 90. That was also signed by Mrs. Min. There are other specific sections. There's section number 31, which is the representation regarding ethics in public procurement. That's page 27 of the contract, or page 94 of the base stamp, or the base page. There's section 22.1, which talks about ethical standards, which is page 105 of the contract, and it's base stamped page 160. There's section 22.2, prohibition against gratuities and kickbacks. That's the contract page 105 and base page 160. There's section 34, compliance with the laws. That's page 27 of the contract or page 97 of the base stamp. There's section 4A, which is general compliance with the laws. That's contract page 94, based at page 149. There's section 17, general compliance with laws. That's contract page 103 and based page 158. And lastly, section 16.8 talks about the Guam debarment and suspension for ethical violations. That's contract page 90 and based page 145. If you recall, when Mr. and Mrs. Min were on the stand, they both testified that they were familiar with each of these sections as we went through them, and that when they submitted their bid package, their intent was to comply with these provisions as well as the entire provisions in the contract. And when they were awarded the contract, it was, again, their intent to adhere to these requirements. But as you can see, we presented evidence that they failed to do so. GSA 5619 is a multi-million dollar contract worth $3.7 million. And it's such a significant contract that SH Enterprises should have realized the repercussions of violating any part of the contract's provisions. And in fact, their action of providing this favor to the government really flies in the face of the procurement laws which were enacted to ensure the integrity and the fairness of this process. GSA is arguing that since the governor has the authority to accept donations, that SH's favor to the government is fine, it's okay, there's no issue regarding that, but we believe that that's an incorrect assessment. SH can make a donation or give a favor to the government anytime they want. They just cannot be a government contractor. That's the rule, plain and simple in and of itself. It's really unambiguous. But if you look at the severity of the violation, this favor of the abuse of the Hakkabuildtown building had occurred a little over 2 months after SH Enterprises was awarded GSA 5619. It occurred right during the pendency of Basil's protest, its first protest. It occurred 7 days before SH submitted its bid packet for GSA 00120, which is food services for Department of Corrections. And it was also within 26 days before it was notified that it was awarded that DOC contract, which is a whopping $5.9 million. So the seriousness of this violation, it's not excusable, and the penalty must match the level of the breach. Their action calls into question its responsibility and its ability to maintain the very ethical standards that it attested to abide by when it was awarded the contract. This violation also goes to the heart of the public's trust, and it's woven into the fabric of our procurement rules and regulations. So we believe, Basil believes, that the only proper remedy is again the termination of GSA 5619, but also the debarment or suspension of SH Enterprises. Those are the only appropriate remedies we see in this case. Thank you, Mr. President.
Thank you very much, Counsel. Ms. Miller.
Good morning, Your Honor. The Chief Procurement Officer in this case testified that if a C rating is received, the emergency procurement in April 2019 was indeed subject to termination. And upon learning of that rating, the procedure would have been, first of all, to contact the using agency, which was Public Health. Public Health, the same agency that issued that C rating. However, before that could happen, before the chief could learn of the C rating, and there's no other way that GSA could know of the rating because they don't monitor the ratings of every individual food vendor, SH withdrew. And upon withdrawal, a legal rescission of that purchase order occurred. So for Basil's argument that there was a termination for cause or a cancellation is incorrect. Once SH withdrew, there was no longer a contract to terminate. So in that respect, looking ahead to the September 2019 IFB, any certification that SH had had a contract terminated for cause, to the extent that it reported no, that was true. The April contract was subsequently awarded to Basil. No damages were suffered by Basil, and Basil makes no claim for damages or demand for action with respect to the April 2019 procurement. Instead, What it does is it attempts to link the April 2019 procurement to the September IFB. Although it does appear from the evidence that SH failed to report the C rating, that rating was remedied by the time the IFB in September was issued, because the procurement record shows that SH current rating at the time of the IFB in September was an A. That is in the procurement record. It is attached to GSA's exhibits as Exhibit H, and the C rating had become an A. When GSA evaluated both SH's and Basil's bill for compliance with the requirements of the procurement law, which is its job to certify that the details of the procurement law, including the certifications, all the various affidavits, and the business license, were met, which it did. Since SH was the lowest bidder, GSA made a recommendation to Public Health that the award go to SH. And then the ball then transfers over to Public Health, because this is their contractor. Now, Public Health, if even if GSA did not know of the C rating, and again, how could it? How could it know the C rating unless it was told, unless it was in the bid package? And even if it was, let's assume if the C rating was there, it had turned into an A, and it was still up to Public Health to make that call. Because Public Health certainly did know of the C rating. You heard testimony that there are only two bidders throughout the last several years, Basil and SH. And these are the same bidders whom Public Health has been dealing with over and over. So they understand the performance history. And one of the reasons for denying Basil's protest at the administrative level was that Basil itself had failed to report its own C and D ratings. Mr. Zhao testified and admitted that the 2016 contract, which is within the 3 years of 2019, that litigation stemmed from a variety of C and D ratings. In 2018, which is definitely within the three-year span, Basil filed an appeal with the Supreme Court over its termination for the C&D ratings arising out of the 2016 litigation. And Mr. Zhao admitted that, yes, that was all part of the same court litigation, and that Basil did not report the ongoings of that court litigation to GSA when it submitted its bid packet. Had the automatic stay been applicable in Basil's 2016 litigation, the stay would have continued until a final resolution by the Guam Supreme Court had been made. And that decision and final resolution only came out in December 2019. That is the 2019 Guam 29 citation that I gave. GSA submits that even though the litigation began in 2016, because it didn't end until December 2019, it was still relevant because a final resolution had not been met, and that the pending nature of the litigation charged Basil with an affirmative duty to report that case pursuant to sections 2.4 and 2.5F of the bid specifications, which requires bidders to list all citations and whether it had had a contract terminated in the preceding 3 years. With respect to the mutual citations of both SH and Basil, GSA testified, Ms. Anita Cruz testified, that in discussions with public health, when after a recommendation had been made by GSA, public health agreed to waive the failures of both parties because both were non-compliant. And to just waive the failure to report all citations as being a minor informality. That leveled the playing field. Basel's non-compliance was waived, and SH's non-compliance was waived. At that point, public health makes its decision. And as the using agency, that is its right to do so. Public health could have disagreed with GSA and redid this project, but it did not. Mr. Zhao also testified that between September 2019, when the bid and the IFE was issued, and October 24, when the bid opening occurred, he knew that SH was one of the bidders to the IFE. His answer to my question about asking whether he knew was, of course I knew. Mr. Zhao also confirmed that he was present at the public bid opening and that SH was present there. They looked at each other, they saw each other. He knew, and he knew of the COD because he's the one who reported it. Based on the testimony of Mr. Zhao, there is no question that Basel, since September 2019, and for sure by October 2019, Basel knew that SH was a bidder and that the C rating, even though it had turned into an A, could potentially be grounds to disqualify. This is true whether or not SH reported the rating. Under the holding, the very, very recent holding of the Guam Supreme Court, in DFS Guam versus AB Wompat Airport, 2020 Guam 14, the 14-day clock to file a protest begins when the aggrieved party, in this case Basel, becomes aware of the underlying facts that give rise to the protest. The underlying facts that give rise to this protest is the C rating that potentially disqualifies SH. And Basel knew about it. When we submit that they knew about it since April. But even if you pushed and pressed pause and gave them all the way till October, this means that they had to file their protest 2 weeks after October 24, 2019. But Basel waited more than a month later until November 22, 2019, which was after the award was paid, and which is way more than the 14 days after the October 24th bid opening. GSA submits that now that all the evidence is before the public auditor, that this protest is untimely, and a directed verdict motion is made requesting that this appeal be dismissed. With respect to the Hakkabotan building protest, Mrs. Min testified that in January 2020, an unidentified lady from the governor's office called her and asked whether the first floor of the Hakkabotan building was vacant. The call was followed up by members of the governor's staff and cabinet, who then asked Mr. and Mrs. Min if they could use that space for the Guam War Claims Processing Center. The chief procurement officer testified that GSA played no role in obtaining the Hakkabotan building for the War Claims Office, and that GSA learned about it, just like the rest of us did, by reading it in the news. Any speculation that GSA awarded the DOC contract to SH because SH made a favor to the territory is unsubstantiated, it is unproven, and there is absolutely no evidence to support that. And we ask that the public auditor give no credence to it. Earlier this year, I guess that was in August, the public auditor reserved decision on GSA's motion for summary judgment with respect to the Hakkabotan building until this hearing is completed. Now that it is completed, GSA renews that motion and requests for a directed verdict. Based the grounds as set forth in that motion are that this protest, the Hakobotok children's protest, must be dismissed because it falls outside the procurement law and it falls outside this office's jurisdiction. Even if an ethical violation occurred, the fact that the procuring agency was the office of the governor and not an agency like Department of Public Works or Department of Agriculture casts a different twist to it, because the governor is allowed out of all the agencies to accept donations. The statute doesn't say she cannot accept donations from current contractors. She's given a lot of leeway in that. And even putting aside the donation statute, the law also allows her to obtain office space as long as the cost is less than $10,000 and the term is less than 5 years. Hakobotan, Mrs. Min testified that the cost of that space, the fair market value, is $5,000. And that actually, if that's not, the statute says total cost, the total cost paid was zero, nothing, because it was free. And the term was 2 weeks, not 5 years. Because of that, we submit that the procurement, that the Hakobotan building, when procured by the governor, it doesn't even fall within the procurement laws. And this office's jurisdiction is to hear appeals arising out of protests concerning the award, method of source selection, or the solicitation itself. GSA also again submits that the protest is outside the jurisdiction because the law says that procurement ethical violations, even if true, are to be brought before a different forum. The Procurement Policy Office has jurisdiction to hear violations by non-employees. In this case, that would be SH. And before the Civil Service Commission, which in this case would be GSA or the Office of the Governor. So for all those reasons, GSA renews its motion. And we request that a directed verdict that both the Hakobotan building protest and the congregate meals protest be dismissed. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Williams?
Thank you, Captain.
Please.
Thank you. The first ultimate issue that we have before the public auditor is whether SH was a responsive or responsible bidder if it did not include the information pertaining to their privacy briefing as part of their bid packet. Now, we believe that Basil and their protests and appeal are improperly conflating the issues of responsiveness and responsibility. Responsiveness of bids is covered by Section 5201G of the Guam Procurement Law, which defines a responsive bidder as a person who submitted a bid which conforms in all material aspects or respects to the invitation for bid. We had GSA, specifically Anita Cruz, testify that she went through her bidder's checklist and identified the forms that were required to be submitted as part of the bid package per that checklist. And that is the basis for determining whether the bid conforms in all material respects to the IFB. Now, this is distinct from a responsibility determination. The responsible bidder is the one who has the capability to carry out the contractor's requirements, the contract's requirements, and it's covered by Section 3116 of the procurement regulations. In an IFB, it's a responsibility is a determination for each bidder. It's not a qualitative comparison between bidders. And between responsive and responsible bidders, price is the ultimate criterion for award. Now, the determination for responsibility is on the basis of information that is part of the bid package and all information that may be submitted or available up to the time of the award. This is provided in Section 3116 of Guam Procurement Regulations, where they discuss both the standards of responsibility and the information required, or the information to be used by the CPO in making that determination. Now, the standards of responsibility say factors to be considered, whether a prospective contractor is responsible is whether they have the means to meet all contractual requirements, including financial, material, equipment, facility, personnel resources, and expertise, and a satisfactory record of performance. So, in turning to Basil's Exhibit 7, page 56, where it discusses sections 2.4 and 2.5, bidder assurances, it's clear that these are factors that go towards responsibility, not responsiveness. Now, how do they determine if these standards were met, aside from what is included in the package? Well, in under section 3611B, it says the prospective contractor shall supply the information required by the procurement officer concerning the responsibility of such contractor. That is what is requested in the bid assurances. Section 3611 goes on to say, if such contractor fails to supply the requested information, the procurement officer shall base the determination of responsibility upon any available information, or may find the prospective contractor non-responsible if such failure is unreasonable. So the question is, were they allowed to make that determination of responsibility on the information they had available to them? The law says yes. Now, if we look at whether they're permitted to do that, or we look at the IFB in page 25 of Basil's Exhibit 7, section 15, this is also consistent. In that section, it states the CPO reserves the right for securing from bidders information to determine their responsibility in accordance with this section. Then it references section 3116. So if we look at these sections on page 56 of Basil's Exhibit 7, and we look at sections 2.4 and 2.5, A, B, C, and so forth. The first section A says, bidder agrees to submit evidence of the latest graded food inspection report issued by the Guam Department of Public Health and Social Services for the past 12 months preceding the submission of the bid. Now we submit, this is not artfully drafted, but in reading this and reading the next section, it's clear they wanted the most recent current food inspection report, and it needed to be within the last 12 months. That's not what Basil is alleging SH failed to do. They are alleging SH failed to provide a old inspection report for a C rating that still was within the 12 months. We believe their interpretation of section 2.5A is erroneous, because if you look at section 2.5B, which follows immediately thereafter, it says, absent food inspection report for the past 12 months, the bidder agrees to undergo an inspection with DPHSS, Division of Environmental Health, prior to receiving award. And then in C, it says, bidder agrees that in the event bidder receives a grade lower than B, pursuant to that previous section, prior to award, then they're disqualified. So that, you know, those are the sections that the CPO, and in conjunction with and consultation with public health, were permitted to make a responsibility determination. They had the information in determining whether SH was responsible, capable, cleanly, safe enough to provide these services to the Manungu, and they did. They made that responsibility determination. This doesn't go towards responsiveness. Now, this is independent. This is not a comparison on between who is cleaner or safer. This is an independent determination of responsibility for each bidder, having determined that SH was responsible and responsive with all material aspects of the bid packet. They had to be awarded the contract because they were the lowest bidder. Now, turning to the second issue, in terms of whether SH's donation of space to the governor's office was a favor in violations of Article 11 of the Guam Procurement Law. We're not saying that this isn't an important question, but SH submits this is not properly before the public auditor. The public auditor has jurisdiction to hear issues that are properly submitted to him. Now, Section 5651, which is the remedies portion of Article 11 of the Guam Procurement Law, says that the right provides that ethics violations may subject a contractor to right to debarment or suspension. The appropriate remedy is through 5426 of the Guam Procurement Law for a breach of ethical standards. Now, if you look at Section 5651D, it says this proceeding, this debarment or suspension, may be imposed in accordance with the procedures set forth in Section 5426 of this chapter for breach of ethical standards of this chapter, provided that such action may not be taken without the concurrence of the Attorney General. The following subsection says all procedures under this section shall be in accordance with the administrative adjudication law. So the appropriate mechanism for determining whether SH has indeed violated Article 11 or ethical standards is not a protest, but is initiated by a petition for suspension or debarment under 5 DCA 5426. Now, Article 11 references back to this procedure. What does this procedure require? It requires reasonable notice to SH or the person involved and reasonable opportunity for that person to be heard. And the chief procurement officer, or as the head of the, as the purchaser, after consultation with the using agency and the Attorney General, then has authority to bar a person for cause from consideration for awards and contracts. Section 5651E requires that this reasonable notice and reasonable opportunity to be heard before the CPO must be in accordance with the administrative adjudication law. So this requires us to look to the administrative adjudication law process, which meant at the agency level, with GSA, SH must have been afforded right to notice, hearing, and even reconsideration before GSA, before this matter could be properly before the public auditor. After SH was afforded that due process required by law at the agency level, then the CPO shall issue a written decision on the alleged ethics violations, and then it may be appealed to the public auditor. That is how the ethical question is properly brought before the public auditor, not via protest. It doesn't matter that we've had a hearing here. SH is required or entitled by law to have a hearing before GSA. Basil has inappropriately attempted to avoid this due process. They have attempted to lump this in with a protest for this procurement, vaguely alleging that this has something to do with the DOC procurement, but the evidence does not show any misconduct, any bad faith, any fraud. So we submit that the ethical question is not yet properly before the public auditor. The public auditor doesn't have jurisdiction to decide this issue, and that Basil must follow the requirements by law. In the end, this is, of course, a question of fairness and integrity. The evidence showed that neither Basil nor SH submitted their prior negative food inspection ratings. However, those prior food inspection reports, not the current inspection reports, were not the material aspects of the bid package that would have determined responsiveness. Further, GSA used the information it had and was well within procurement regulations and law to make a determination of responsibility of SH based on the information they did have, which would have included the food inspection rating and even their knowledge and awareness of past performance and the prior C rating. This was a determination made independent of Basil. There was no unfairness, and the contract was properly awarded to SH as the lowest bidder. And again, with respect to the alleged ethics violation, the evidence does show that the governor's office used the Hakkabutan building. Mrs. Min responded to a request from the governor's office. Mrs. Faji testified that she was only aware of this incidentally through the news. This was not in connection with any procurement, not this contract, not this matter, not DOC, not the DOC contract. There was no evidence of bad faith, no evidence of fraud, no evidence of intent to gain favor by the by GSA as the purchasing agency. But more importantly, this is these questions have to be resolved within the due process of law, meaning Basil can petition to GSA as the agency. They have to have a hearing and the notice and all the evidentiary requirements and the reconsideration opportunity that is afforded by law before this matter can properly be before the public auditor. So on these two main issues, on the responsiveness and responsibility and the ethics issue, we ask that Basil's protest be denied. Thank you.
Thank you. Do you wish to respond?
Just a short response, Mr. Cruz. Basil had submitted briefs regarding jurisdiction. We also discussed this issue in our hearing brief. And last week we filed a response to GSA Supplemental Authority regarding the airport case and DFS. So it's respectfully requested that you review those filings when making your decision. A few things I wanted to clarify, too. Attorney Miller indicated that when she questioned my client yesterday regarding his knowledge as to when SH Enterprises knew, as to when Basil knew SH Enterprises had submitted a bid, he initially said that between September 29th through October 24th, he knew that they had submitted a bid. But then when I questioned him yesterday, I clarified that because he indicated that on September 29th, he picked up the bid packet and he looked through the list of people who signed in. He saw SH's name signed in and a few other names. But at that point in time, there's no way he could have known that SH would in fact issue a bid or turn in a bid. He did attend the bid opening on October 24th. He saw that SH was there. And that's when he knew that SH had actually turned in the bid. So it wasn't prior to the bid opening. It was actually on October 24th. In regards to that catalyst of when he was aggrieved or aware of a violation such that he would be entitled to a remedy, that didn't occur until November 8th. Which is when they were provided notice that the bid would be awarded to SH Enterprises. As Ms. Cruz stated yesterday, she makes a check mark to ensure that all the documents are turned in, but she also has to do an analysis of the information and she has to send it to the using agency, in this case, Public Health. Public Health does their analysis. If there's an issue, I'm assuming that would be brought up. Then it has to be reviewed by Ms. Alfazi. So the only time Basil knew that they would be aggrieved, that they were aggrieved, was when they received notice that SH was awarded the contract. And another thing I wanted to point out is, during the testimony yesterday, it was quite curious that when Ms. Cruz would look at the document to see what was turned in. Essentially, the only thing that she was looking for was the list of documents on page 75 of Basil's Exhibit 7, the bid guarantee form, the statement of qualifications, the affidavit disclosing ownership and commission, and the other documents regarding non-collusion, wage determination, restriction against sexual offenders, etc. Apparently, they didn't feel that prior withdrawal from a contract, prior non-conformance with a contract, was something material. They said, well, let's just leave it to Public Health. And then there was a statement made by Attorney Miller saying, well, that was Public Health's job. They know the priority rating. They should have known about it, and if there's an issue, they would have brought it up. But no one knows what Public Health was thinking or looking at or analyzing because no one from Public Health testified to that. There's just an assumption. So the contract comes back to, or the analysis comes back to GSA, and they sign off on it, and there's no indication regarding what analysis was taken aside from that analysis report, which is SH Exhibit D as in David. It's a bid analysis report prepared by Ms. Cruz the day after the bid opening. So, on October 24th, during the bid opening, that contract could have been awarded to anyone. And there was an issue regarding what factors GSA was actually looking at. So the only time that it could have been agreed was when the contract was actually awarded on November 8th.
Ms. Miller and Ms. Williams, I'll allow you to address something because it's concerning me. How is a bidder supposed to know what GSA or the procuring agency is going to deem material and relevant to the awarding of the bid? If the IFB states that you're supposed to list citations from the prior 3 years, and it's not, and if the bid opening, it's not something that GSA considers important in its list on page 75, because that should be under the purview and the knowledge of the purchasing agency. How is a bidder to know that the failure to provide a document is going to be held against a fellow bidder as being non-responsive or non-responsible until such time as the award is announced? And I'll even take into account Ms. Williams' position that the bid is inartfully written in that the request is for citations in the last 12 months, but whether or not it's the most current one in October, if they got an A, and disregard the fact that they'd had one in April, or even why the IFB was written in the way that it was, where it's within the last 3 years. Is that to be held against the bidders and used to confuse the trier of fact as to what was intended? Because I mean, it would seem to me, I mean honestly, that because it's involving Mununko, that they would have wanted to know everything from the last 3 years and more importantly the last month, I mean the last year of ratings. That's obviously not something that GSA finds important because it's not on their list checklist, which escapes me. But how is the bidder supposed to know that the non-inclusion of something is going to be used, is not going to be held against a fellow bidder until such time as the award is made, so that when the time tolls?
I think that question presumes that the bidder, a bidder, knows the knows which documents are missing from the competitor's bid. And there is no way that one bidder would know what is in a competitor's bid packet. Even after, almost, you're only allowed to, the only thing that becomes public under the procurement law is the winning bidder's packet. The losing bidder's packets are never open for public inspection. And there's at least three different portions of the procurement regulations where it says that. So a bidder could only analyze the winning bidder's packet, and only after the award was made, if that's what you're asking. But at the bid opening, they would not know. And then you would have a protest similar to this, that it becomes a post award. But in this particular case,
but as you put it, they would know what Basil would not have known what SH had submitted in its bid until and unless SH was awarded the bid and it was announced. And then they could go through it and discover this document's missing, this document's missing, this document's missing. Otherwise, how could they, under your, how could they possibly know that document was missing?
That sounds like a correct. Only Mr. Bono wants to clarify.
Your Honor, if I may, at the bid opening, all bids are allowed to be copied after the bid opening and closed. So then, right after that, if a person, another bidder, wishes to make a copy, they can make a FOIA request. And then we do make copies and make it available.
Of the opposing bids?
Pardon?
Of the opposing bids?
Of any request. At the bid opening, right after bid opening, if bidder A, if there's three bidders, if a bidder A wishes to make copies of bidder B and C's bid document submission, they are allowed to do so, provided we check to make sure anything more confidentiality is taken out.
Okay, and in that regard, I stand corrected because the CPO has told me that where it's all closed and you don't get to see the other bidder's proposals is RFP. RFPs, only the winning bidder's proposal is public.
After an award.
So Mr. Kono has corrected me that during bid, they can FOIA it. So in response, how would the other one know? They could FOIA it. But
okay. And how is Basil supposed to have known that when even government counsel didn't know that?
Well, the difference here is that Basil knew of the facts, that is the C rating, that was potentially
And even if they did, how would they know that it was not going to be held against them?
Not held against them, Basil, or not held against them?
Not held against SH, that they had had a C rating the previous April.
They don't know just as much as they don't know. SH doesn't know that Basil's past performance will not be held against.
I understand, and I'm trying to figure out why you would include things in the IFB if it's not going to be something that is material to the decision.
Well, the decision is a joint decision made in collaboration with the using agency. It is not just many times.
And how is how are the other bidders supposed to know what's going to happen? I'm doing the collaborative discussion between the using agency and the general services agency on what is and is not important.
Actually,
I mean, I can understand there's that whole argument at one point where everybody believed that the fact that a business license was not there or some of the other documents were not there, those things can be cured. You can say, well, you didn't provide a copy of your business license or who your major shareholders are. That can be cured even after the opening and the award. But what cannot be cured is whether or not an important factor of non-compliance with food statute at some point in the previous 12 months, and whether or not they knew or didn't know it. Neither Ms. Akfaji or Ms. Cruz knew that the C rating was in their file someplace. Ms. Akfaji testified she'd never seen it. So it was addressed to her, and one of you made her testify, isn't that a GSA stamp in the bottom? How is a bidder supposed to know that you've taken that into account? And if it wasn't, if it's not required, then why do you put it in, especially something that important that you can't say, yes, I had a copy of it, of my business license, or here are the major stockholders, and here's my collusion thing that I neglected to include. Yeah, I could see that being something that could be provided later. But when it's not weighed into the fact that the person could not be responsible because they weren't responsive in providing documents about their ability to be able to provide clean food or timely service, how are the other bidders supposed to know until such time as the award is made?
If I may, I think Ms. Williams went through the analysis already of the 12 months preceding. But with respect to, and I'm trying to answer your question, sir, is that nothing in the procurement law charges a bidder that he has to have actual knowledge of something that has happened. All he has to know is he's got potentially disqualifying facts. And when they, Basil, saw SH at the bid opening and armed with the knowledge that why are they here? They should not be here. I think they should be disqualified. At that point, and no award had been made, and they could have filed a protest the very next day. I protest that this guy was able to submit a bid. He should not have been able to, because I think he should be disqualified. He does not have to wait until there is an actual award. And that's what the DFS case says. So using that standard, I would submit that it's not that you have to absolutely have actual knowledge that this document was not there and that public health disregarded it or GSA disregarded it. If a bidder suspects, it's a very low standard. If a bidder suspects that something is amiss, he should file a protest and not sit on it and wait for action to be taken, because that is adverse to him. Because now you are in a post-award position. Whereas if he had filed it pre-award, the automatic stay would have been invoked. And with that stay, this all could have been resolved and this hearing could have happened.
So you're proposing that this office be deluged with a whole slew of procurement appeals that straight from the from the day that the awards are, I mean, not the awards, but the what the bids are announced.
If
I knew that this is an off-island company, I can protest it, and it's going to be before the OPA, because I saw that someone from off-island filed, and there should be a local preference, and so I'm going to file a local preference. Well, how do you know that the GSA isn't going to give you the local preference, and you're going to get the bid? You're supposed to have protested the fact that GSA even allowed an off-island bidder to bid when they should have just accepted it from. They should only accept it from Guam-based corporations because there's the local bid, I don't know whether or not my 15% is going to be enough to get me under. I hate to see what the number of appeals we're going to get.
No one is suggesting that this office be deluged with frivolous protests. But if a bidder has grounds to file a protest, and the law affords him certain rights to do so, then that bidder should protect his rights and do whatever he needs to.
I understand, Ms. Miller, but that's what I'm saying with the example of an off-island. How do I know how they're going to weigh the 15% difference?
You don't know.
And so, but I should have filed it. I should have filed it in last March when I went in and I saw on the list that off-island company A had picked up a packet. When does this know or should have known go back to?
Well, according to the DFS.
Shouldn't it be known or should have known and is aggrieved? Because otherwise an off-islander picked it up, and so what? It's frightening.
There is an analysis of when do you become an aggrieved bidder.
Ms. Williams, do you wish?
If I might, to answer your question about, is this, maybe to assuage your fears that this is going to encourage frivolous protests, I don't think that's the question here. It's not like a local preference or evaluation of an RFP where we don't know what the evaluators are going to give certain weight or how they're going to score them. In an IFB, and in this particular IFB, we're talking about a responsibility determination, black and white. And I believe that the evidence shows that Basil thought under no conditions could SH be responsible based on their belief that the contract should have been terminated for cause, that they had a C rating. They didn't believe they could be responsible under any condition, and they believed that at the time of the bid opening on October 24th when the bids were accepted. So that is why the clock should have run then. I think that this case is distinguishable. It's not going to set a dangerous precedent. I think based on the evidence and the facts at hand and the fact that this is an IFB in particular, that Basil can be charged with being with the knowledge of the facts they say they were aggrieved of, that they believe SH could not be a responsible bidder under any circumstance.
Can you help them? Call the coroner, wish. Trying to I'm really seriously trying to figure out how far back DFS is saying that we're supposed to take these things into account. And how that's going to break things open. On the ethics question, I know you filed a motion, and I've taken it under advisement. I am probably going to be ruling against it, because this happened during this procurement appeal. If I had issued my decision already on the initial procurement appeal, and it was outside of this office, I no longer had it before me, I might say, well, the ethics thing isn't here. But the fact that it was allegedly offered and testified to, it was accepted, because the ethics violation is not only the offer but the accepting. During the pendency of this appeal, it's something that this is within for me to consider it at this point, in the same way that where I'm sitting as a judge, the fact that you bought the presiding a new Mercedes, that may have nothing to do with my decision as a trial court judge. That might not affect it, except for maybe I'd be insulted. I wasn't. And so that's why, when I was there, the rule was no cakes, no bottles of booze. Everything should be sent away. We tried to stop that practice, and even the practice of giving it to the Court Employees Association, I found to be highly questionable. The ethics provisions are very strict, and the period in which it covers goes all the way to the warranty period, when they're no longer a vendor. They could give anything that they want, but as long as there's a pending action. This one, there was actually a pending contract, a pending appeal. I'm not going to consider whether or not it had anything to do with DOC, though it looks awful. It's during the pendency of this one. I will deny your motion and will issue a written and let them across the street figure out whether or not I've read it too strictly. But I really have problems with any kind of action, especially during the pendency of this case. And the statute's clear, de minimis. But as it relates to the known or should have known, you can all try to convince me about that in your trial briefs. I mean, in your findings of fact and conclusions of law, and how to be able to address that. Because, I mean, I'm glad I'm not the only one that was ill-informed if government counsel didn't know that someone could copy the IFBs. And even if the IFB is, could be copied, but for GSA excluding any trade secrets, how would another bidder know that the engine that's being provided by bidder C meets with the basic parts of the IFB if that part is considered to be a trade secret because it's from Tesla? You can respond.
Thank you, Your Honor. What has happened in the past is if vendor two requests a FOIA, and we give them a FOIA, and they complain about vendor one or file a protest about vendor one failing to do something in the bid package. Well, if we take their protest and say we will get back to you, because we still have to do, GSA still has to do its due diligence in determining whether or not that is correct, or we have other grounds for our decision, and then we get back to them. But they have preserved the right to file a protest within the period of time authorized by law.
And when does the time start to run? From the date that they've asked for the FOIA, or the day that they finally receive the information and know that it's...
The period of time usually begins upon the bid submission, but if they look at the... Because we try to give the FOIAs after a bid opening the same day, once they just make the request for a FOIA for us on the bid package. We don't delay it. So that's the time they have the bid documents of vendor number one. So that's the day they know or should have known by looking at the documents.
And if information on the bid documents are redacted and not provided because of trade secret or financial secrets, what if one of those things is something critical to whether or not they could be responsible? How are they supposed to know until you award it to Tesla? I don't know that the engine's going to be able to perform as well as my Ford or my GMC.
Just based on past experience, Your Honor, I can only say that when we've had problems with a vendor in terms of determining whether they're capable or not, we have asked outside agencies to provide us some assistance, and we have gone to, for example, the Department of Administration Chief Financial Officer for assistance in to make determinations of the feasibility of an agent's of a vendor's capability or not. So we do try to.
I understand. I'm still grappling with trying to figure out how DFS is going to affect the operations of this office.
DFS.
The DFS decision.
I can't tell you how the Supreme Court case.
No, I know it's supposed to be supreme and paramount, but I'm just saying how it's going to affect the operations here in trying to figure out when everybody knows or should have known, and when they should have filed it.
I think Your Honor, in terms of my own personal reading of the Supreme Court case, I believe what the Supreme Court did was try to limit people from new or should have known filing the protest by going back and emphasizing that particular section of law where the protester knew or should have known when to file the basis for the of filing a protest in this particular case. The vendor knew or thought that a basis for filing a protest was when a C rating was issued and therefore should have been terminated. However, he did.
Or as a hypothetical, Ms. Miller, our office did a performance audit on the inaugural committee funds. Okay, and your argument that that the governor's office under statute is allowed to receive money, if some of those donors are vendors, and are now getting preferred treatment, is the protest by losing companies going to be forever precluded because that donation was made 2 years ago and everybody knew or should have known, or should have known after we came out with our listing of all the vendors?
Only 14 days, or so.
So it'd be 14 days from
the new or should have known. And I wouldn't know how to answer that question. So, but I understand
I'm grappling with this whole thing and trying to get the governor's office to understand that people figure that that's the top, and if I gift that, maybe I'm going to, you know, be dealt with nicely all the way down. I mean, we had another case that thankfully I think resolved, where it involves the buses, and one of the allegations of the bidder of the losing bidder is that it was getting preferential treatment because of its close relationship with the administration, and they could have probably even listed they made a $50,000 donation to the inaugural committee. Is it too late to bring that up as a possibility of why they got that bid? Because that was 2 years ago? Or should anybody just protest the fact that anybody whose name is on the inaugural committee's donor list, as soon as I see that they picked up a packet from any bid from now on, in order to meet the Supreme Court's DFS argument, that I should immediately I should file a protest immediately that they can no longer be vendors for Government of Guam? In the health insurance, one should take care, be precluded from submitting a bid for health insurance because it provided a donation to the inaugural committee? That's why those statutes were written. And it just, this, your absolute power of the governor to accept money really frightens me. Okay, next Wednesday, anybody who wants to file trial brief, I mean, findings of fact and conclusions of law that assist me in working through the issues that I have raised, I'd appreciate it.
So, will you be requiring a remedies brief?
You can, please?
Or did you be put that on? That usually happens a week after.
Yeah. No, so usually when we set the scheduling order and it has that date, it's usually a week after. So of course, if the change of the hearing date, it's we kind of keep to that a week after filing, because I know it already had passed. Yeah.
And Basil filed.
Yeah.
So I'm just trying to figure out what it is that.
Assist the trier with anything you can, with suggestions. And expand on your argument of what that citation should be. That was a... Okay. We are adjourned.
Thank you.
We're off the record at 10:28 a.m.